Hi, good morning, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to thank Scott and the host committee for that phone call. And I know Peggy, and I, boy, are you missing out? I didn't do it. I didn't trip her or anything. I was in California at the time, but, I mean, she's an amazing woman. 47 years sober this last week. She turned 47, and whoa. And so hopefully she'll get to be back here next year or something, because boy. I'm really glad to be here. Has this not been an amazing weekend?
Yes.
Right? I arrived after Michelle's talk, so I'm going to listen to her CD on the way home, or when I get home. But Ned and then Kip and Matthew, two of my favorite speakers in the world, I got to hear and sit with a little bit this weekend. And Matthew, I've heard him several times, and he didn't say it last night, but with his permission, I'm going to say it this morning. And it's a line that he expresses a lot. And when he talks about doing the next indicated thing, he says, sometimes doing the next indicated thing is turning the alarm clock off and getting up and reporting for duty. And sometimes the next indicated thing is something so big and beautiful it'll make your heart explode. And if you're new, I want to invite you to come in here and have a few of those moments too. Alcoholics Anonymous does not remove the problems from my life, but it allows me to walk through them awake and alive, and not having to take a drink and not having to make them worse. That is for sure. I'm so glad to be here, and it's good to see Bill and Brian from Dicope Tapes. And, you know, you get to out on the road, and you get to meet dealers, and it's always good to have a nod and a hug and a cup of coffee and meet friends I haven't met before. And I know you're always here. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you that I'm an alcoholic because of the crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family I had. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And I've been around here now long enough to know that there are people who went through far worse childhoods than I ever went through. And when they pick up a drink, alcohol does not do for them what it did for me. They didn't become alcoholic. They found a way through their lives, and they moved on. And I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough now to know that there are people who live charmed childhoods. Nothing happened to them. They were loved and wanted and needed and had everything. And yet, when they pick up a drink of alcohol, the same thing happens to them that happens to me. They can't control the amount they're going to take, and when they stop, they can't stay stopped for any period of time without going crazy. And, you know, they're just as sick as I am, and they sit right next to me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's not that. My family gave me an inventory, but they didn't make me alcoholic. And I don't want you to think it was all bad either, though. I had a great time in elementary school. Fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were terrific. I was a participator. I love everything. I was a new kid on the block in school a lot, so I found my way in by being the first around the track and the best in sports and into school politics and good in academics. I know the answer, and God, just needed to be on top and in charge and the first and the best. And by the time sixth grade was over, I was tired and I needed a drink. You know, when you're running the world and you're 10, it's a big job. And I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. I don't think they game these days. They just get right down to business. But we played it back then. It was a summer between 6th and 7th grade going up into, I think they call it middle school now, but we called it junior high. And I was at my friend Leonard's house, and we were playing spin the bottle with a few friends and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And now those weren't the first drinks I ever took, but those were the drinks that I started to take where I made a connection that alcohol would do something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And so we were playing this game, and the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair, if you want to know the truth. But But every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get. So I just couldn't accept the things I couldn't change. You know, I didn't understand some of those unwritten rules, like good girls do and say they don't, or don't and say they do. I still don't think I have it right, but I beat my head against the wall and couldn't figure out why you wouldn't move the wall. And it got very uncomfortable. I mean, I had been real active and had some friends, and there were some outside influences going on then, too. There was a lot of racial tension where I went to school, and so there were some outside influences. But, man, I started to drink, and I started to drink with a purpose, and alcohol really started to act for me, started to do something for me. I mean, I started to back away from my life. I got a reputation I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for in junior high. And girls my age were looking at me funny, and boys my age were looking at me funny. And I just, my pride kicked in, my feelings got hurt, and I started to back away from my life. And that's what I do to say. And I started hanging out in the girls' room more than I did the classroom and with the other girls who were backing away from their lives. And bringing stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and hanging out until after a while school just wasn't working for me anymore. And I don't know about you, but I'm a traveler. I'm a road warrior. I'm a runner. I identified with Merle Haggard when I was 6 years old. You know, I just, all it takes really for me is a Willie Nelson song and a long, slow train whistle, and I'm on the road again. You know, I just get out there on that freeway on-ramp and on that 10 freeway going east and the 101 going north, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp and I'd crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And that's where I wanted to be, was somewhere else. It just felt like hope was just up the road. And because I was young, I started getting picked up and spending a little time in the Southern California hotspots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and LA Central Juvenile Hall, and they tried to send me home to mom and home to dad, and we did that whole dance for a little while. And to school, the more I would go out on the road, the more those feelings of difference increased, and I just started to back away. I found it very difficult to reintegrate myself back into class, and I certainly wasn't going to tell them where I'd been on my summer vacation, that's for sure. And so I just started to run. And when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area where a couple of guys offered my friend and I money for sex. And we said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. I started letting old men stick needles in my arms, and my life began to change dramatically from there. And it just seemed to me that more people were out there on the street doing what I knew to do than they were back at home. And I decided that this was the normal life. This is where I belong. And I ran there until the courts took over. I was 15, and they admitted me to a mental hospital. I was supposed to be weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. Just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism then. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I haven't had to experience in a very long time, and it's even hard to remember. I like Clancy says, I remember now because I heard a tape once that said I remembered. So it's a good thing to be so far down the road that I can't bring back that. But I didn't know how to talk about what was going on in my family. I didn't know how to talk about what was going on with me. I didn't know that was necessary, really. And I had a pretty big ego. And they were giving me daily nutritional supplements, of Thorazine, Melaril, Dalmane, Valium. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. And that's what I looked like when I was 15. The only reason that I know I'm an alcoholic all these years later is that when I was washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous on September 25th of 1987, sick and tired, and surrendered just enough to start picking up these spiritual tools, I found out that when I apply Alcoholics Anonymous to my disease, I get better. And that's how I know I'm an alcoholic. This wasn't a treatment center, it was a mental hospital. So some of my roommates had some real diseases, and they're not, they need to be recognized. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference because I, as an untreated alcoholic, I look a lot like those schizophrenics and manic depressives. But I found that, again, when I'm surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, all I've needed is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't want to go crazy, got to get busy, though. And one of my favorite ways to be busy, I've already told you, was boys. I loved all the boys. But my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types. You know the kind. Some of you are in here this morning. You can see the smoke, you know. You just never really knew when they were going to blow. And I love those guys. I found them very exciting. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. In fact, my fiancé, his name's Doug R., and he's from Tahunga. A lot of you guys know him and have heard him talk, and he's just full of joy. He's full of joy. He's got no recent prison experience, and he's perpetually happy, so I almost missed him. But anyway, the guys I liked in the Nut House, they were trying to escape their junior prison sentences, so they were hanging out there, and but they'd eventually blow, and they'd get hauled off to YA, California Youth Authority, or something, and I'd have to say goodbye to them. Like, my first boyfriend blew, and he threw a chair through the window, and my next boyfriend blew, and he threw a nurse through the window, so that was progressive, too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, you know, music playing in the background of all this sweet drama going on. And I remember one afternoon sitting outside on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window. And I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench smoking my tragic cigarettes and watching this whole ordeal go down. And we used to play those sentimental love songs like, "When Will I See You Again?" Oh my God, there are some real sickos in here this morning. I can tell. Just inside the girls' unit, I can hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," then just it took me a long time to realize I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. This is what's going on between my ears. It's the way I see my life, you know, and I'm always about... I always think it's going to come from out there what's going to fix me. And besides that, I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I'm looking at anyway. You know, I mean, I mistake arrogance for confidence. I mistake brute strength for strength of character. I mistake sex for love. I get it up into my life and it turns to dust because it's just not real. It's counterfeit. Just not the thing. It took coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for me to learn it's when I give of myself that gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. Never going to come from out there. Took a long time to get here, though. I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the Ward D, or it's the ward where they put all the patients they don't know what to do with anymore. And by then, I was a real vision for you. I had beat my head against the wall through that year. I'd found my way over the fence or under the gate sometimes when I'd need a party, you know. Sometimes, I don't know whose bright idea this was, but they'd walk us through the front lobby with an unlocked door, and I put my street clothes on under my pajamas. And if you time it just right when you're walking through that lobby and they're looking the other way, boom, you can make a run for it. And sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't, but it's always worth a shot. And I'd stay out for a week or two, and then I'd come back in the front door. That was my home. That's where I lived. And so now I'm on Ward D, and I'm a vision for you. I've got casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I've been cutting, because that's a whole different way to change my reality and my perception of life and have a little release. And I'm no longer bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in the Nut House. And sit on the couch in the day room and smoke my cigarettes. I met... the man of my dreams there. He was admitted there early one morning, and he came in. He was kicking heroin in 17 days like we do, you know, 17 days. And it took me a long time to realize there had to have been something wrong with him, too. You know, he looked across the room and saw me and said, "Her. I gotta have her." And I always think it's just me, so it was nice to realize maybe he... I ended up going over the wall with him and did that dance through my whole adolescence, back into juvenile hall, and I was with him for about 2 weeks, and my probation officer, oddly enough, knew exactly where to find me, and it took me a little while, and it hurt my feelings to find out he'd called her. She's right here. Come get her. Back into juvenile hall and back into a rehab and in and out and waiting for placement and sitting in front of a judge and waiting for placement and waiting for placement. And I ended up in a girls' home in Pasadena at the end of all of that. I was 17 and I met my roommate and I was still kind of a little bit optimistic. I guess I was just young and a little bit resilient, but I met my roommate, and I've always been a seeker. I want to tell you that I've always believed in God. I felt the presence of God long before I ever took a drink. I've experienced forgiveness and love, and I felt I believed in God. I knew there was a God, but I just didn't know how to establish it with God. I was born into a Southern Baptist family, and that religion worked really well for my mom. She loved it. She trusted it till the day she died. Didn't work for me so much. I kept thinking there must be something more, and I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in fourth grade, and I'm as deep as a mud puddle, really. Sometimes I just, if it doesn't work right away, I gotta go, and burned black candles for a couple of years, praying to the other guy, just trying to hedge my bets, really. I just want to be on the side that's winning. I don't care. The best idea of strength and serenity that I could come up with, that I could really attach myself to and continue to seek in that direction, was a combination of the spirit of the 60s, or what I thought the 60s might have been. There was the Grateful Dead and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and they marched. They marched everywhere, and they said, no, and we're not going to take it, and they fought, and for a purpose. They all had a purpose, and there was peace and love and flowers. And I didn't know how they were doing all of that, but I knew I wanted some of that. And when I was in the sixth grade, the television series Kung Fu came out. And I don't know if some of you remember that that series, but David Carradine played a Shaolin priest. And that dude walked the Wild West in bare feet. He was tough. And pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue. He could change your life in three words. And I wanted what he had. The best part about him was when they messed with him, he kicked their ass. And I wanted what he had. So combination of all of this, and this is my God. So I'm reading books about channeling and Baba Ram Dass, Be Here Now, and trying to figure out exactly what that means. And all the while I'm drinking and using a lot of things. And it took, when I got sober, I realized that everything I put into access that power greater than myself were the very things that blocked me. And now, thank God it's all it is, but I'm the one that blocks me most of the time. And we got a program for that. So this is my idea, and I meet my roommate in this girl's home, and she's on the same page as me. And we're talking to our friends about these people, and they said, man, all those people, they moved to Oregon. They went from San Francisco to Oregon. And so we went up to Oregon where God might be, and we went out the second-story window of that girl's home, down the tree, and into Randy's truck, and off to Eugene, Springfield, Oregon. And I wasn't doing what I'd been doing to make a living up there for a little while. I thought my life would change from the outside in, When they talk about hoeing in Eugene, Oregon, they meant with a garden tool, So it's a whole different way of looking at things. They did it in their front yard, And two things happened that I could only see looking back. And one was that I couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. And when I've got no sufficient substitute, I've got no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I am restless, irritable, and discontent, very hard to get along with. And when I can drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark, and that was happening again and still at 17 years old. And my friends had to eventually ask me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I ended up in a roundabout way back down in my father's house against his better judgment, and he let me stay there for a little while. And every morning we'd get up at the same time, and he'd take off for work, and I'd take off for his den, and I'd go sit in his den, and I'd drink from his liquor cabinet, and he didn't drink a drop. I don't know why he had all this booze. I was weaned on like Chivas Regal and stuff. I didn't have any idea what that meant. But he was a businessman, and he got a lot of that stuff for Christmas. And he didn't touch a drop, so I figured it must be there for me. And he'd take off for work, and I'd start drinking. And he'd come home in the afternoon and see me sitting in the seat he left me that morning. And he'd look at me with those brokenhearted eyes. And I didn't have an answer for him. I didn't know how to tell him I was afraid. I didn't know that's what I was. I didn't know how to tell him I didn't know where the last few years of my life had gone. I just sat there and I drank. And right before my 18th birthday, he had asked me to leave. And I know that was the hardest thing he ever had to do, was to ask his oldest daughter to leave his house again. And on my way out the door, all I could remember was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And today I know I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. And I was 18 years old, start my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. And there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And even to this day, I love it when a young lady asks me for a ride, either to or from Hollywood, and I get to pass by that same bus stop on Sunset Boulevard near Poinsettia Avenue, and I get to see a whole new generation of the same girls sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different. And I get to say a prayer of gratitude for me and a prayer of hope for her that maybe someday she'll find what I found, if alcoholism is a problem. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and and I moved in with him that night. And I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name. But but I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my eight-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. I had gone through his life physically, materially, spiritually, mentally, in every way I could, and he'd been nothing but kind to me. No good deed for him went unpunished for that 6 weeks. And I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking for him. Went everywhere I knew to look, and my sponsor finally said, "You're going to have to set that down for a while, Carla. If you find him, you'll find him, but you got to open up to some other things. You got a lot to do, and if you're supposed to find him, you will, but in God's time, not yours." And so I did, and she said, "There are a few things you can do, like to start changing yourself, though, right now, and one of them is, like, try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there?" And and I got to tell you, you know, all these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend and how to have a friend. And I got to tell you that right up there with that feeling of being useful is that feeling of self-respect. And that is valuable to me. And I have come close to trading that away a time or two in my sobriety, and I am not willing, just not willing. When I step in that mud puddle there, I step right back out real fast. And I got to clean it up because I don't want to lose that. I can look you in the eye, and I can look your wife in the eye, and I like that. We all like that. You know, about right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going, and thank God you guys have taught me it's what I do, not how I feel, that matters. I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. I just didn't. I just want to be invited. I don't really want to go anywhere, And you guys taught me to show up. You just taught me to show up and see what happens. And I went out there and I gave that talk, and of course I felt better. And at the end of that meeting, when the thank you line came through, this man stopped and he said, "Where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. And only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get that done in my first year, couldn't make it happen. Couldn't get it done. Couldn't make it happen. And so I like to tell that story because it reminds me that God's timing is always when I don't think it's happening fast enough. And it occurred to me later that had I found him in my first year, he wasn't sober yet. Maybe he wouldn't have heard it the same way he did when he had 8.5 years of sobriety. So again, God's timing is always perfect. And I need to remember that today. You know, when I'm out of work and I'm looking and I can't, and things don't seem in my mind to be clicking just right. And I come back to that story and I remember, oh yeah, you know. My friend Rachel used to say that you're in the middle of a miracle so big you can't even see the sides of it. And so I like that. I didn't see that coming. And I got to make those direct amends to him, you know. And he said, "Oh, my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive." And he's right. You know, if we're in this room this morning, we're the lucky ones. Somehow, some way, we've managed to slip through that window of grace long enough to come in here and sit down and recharge and regroup together and help another alcoholic and go out and think about somebody else for a change and be useful in this world and stay alive without a drink and relatively happy and usefully whole. That was a long time to come. You know, I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another boyfriend. The rehabs are full of boyfriends, we know. And he was from an earlier one. And we hooked up and we were both on the same page again, both loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And we beat each other up and down the California coast, and we hitched a ride up to the mountains in southern Oregon and pitched a tent there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, until the baby came. And then we had this little girl, and I thought having this little girl was going to change the way that I drank. I thought, you know, first baby, then booze. Baby, then booze. Change priorities. And we all know that alcoholism doesn't care who you love. It doesn't matter. And I was drinking that herbal stuff, homemade wine, homemade moonshine. You know, it's organic and much better for you, and it doesn't matter. I still can't control the amount I'm going to take, and then I'm miserable when I've got nothing and I've got no sufficient substitute. She got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her away. I took her up to Idaho, where it's got to be better somewhere else, right? Hope is just up the road. And we're up there, and I've got three jobs, tending bar and cocktail waitressing, and any normal person could have made a great living doing what I was doing, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. My kid's one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And I drug her from one rent-by-the-week motel to the next, to the next, to the next. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for me anymore either. I'm drinking straight scotch. I'm not mixing it with anything because, you know, those bubbles give you a hell of a hangover, really, and not really good for you. I'm back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina. I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar. Again, not a bad place to work. I'm the common denominator in that. Hollywood's about 40 miles away from Covina, where I lived, and so I had to take a break in between, right? I'd leave Covina and stop in Arcadia at this bar called The First Cabin. I'd stop in there, and I'd have my primer drink, so shots of Cuervo Gold and Budweiser backs that got me ready to get up and go do my shift in Hollywood. And I'd go to Hollywood, then pour drinks till the wee hours of the morning, drink with everybody, and crawl back home and start all over again. And I did that for months on end. And my daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye and do that cycle and come back home. And one afternoon I kissed her goodbye and I took off and I sat at that same bar in Arcadia and had those same shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud backs. And the only thing to this day that I can see that was different on that day from the day before was 24 hours. Because I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool, and I had those shots of Gold and Bud backs, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of it. So I sat on that bar stool, and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I sat and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there. And I'd do the rounds. I'd start at the Drinkers Hall of Fame early in the morning down the street, and then I'd come back up to Steerberger and down to Kelly's and up to Tommy T's and back next door to The First Cabin. And it'd be around midnight, and I'd hear the band playing, and I'd start thinking about my daughter, because I like to think about things I have no control over when I can't do anything about them. And I'd sit and I'd think, and my gut would wrench and my throat would close, and I knew that you could walk her up to me in that moment and say I could have her back if I just stopped drinking. If I just stopped drinking, I knew that that wasn't going to happen. I couldn't have told you in these words then, but alcohol had become my absolute priority. And I'm convinced and conceited to the idea today that if Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't remain my priority, alcohol may again become it. Even if Alcoholics Anonymous works so good in this moment that I never needed another meeting again, I owe you so much. I owe you so much. I got to be here for the new one who comes in and needs the same thing I needed when I walked in these doors. I had to stop calling to find out how my daughter was because she was asking me those hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And I had no idea, and I knew that she was better off where she was. I thought maybe getting married might do the trick. I found another job at another dive bar, and now the bars that I'm working in are getting, and the people and me, we're all getting increasingly rustic. And I met the man that I would marry, and I thought maybe if I made my life look like I thought yours was, maybe if I got this, moved into an apartment and got everything back together, maybe that would do it. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into that apartment, and we became an active household. I threw the first punch in that relationship because he walks toward me, and I know what I got to do and just give it the best right cross I can come up with. Those are the relationships that I had. We bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the Night Stalker, and the only people we turned that gun on ever was each other. I just tried to get to it first. And my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of those fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool. And I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs, and nobody feeling sorry for me in that bar, just glad I was leaving. And my husband had to pick me up and take me to the hospital. And I can't tell you the amount of times I had to put him at cross purposes. You know, he had to try to kill me and save my life all at the same time, you know, sometimes. And so we went to the hospital, and I got fixed up, and he brought me home. And before he left for work that weekend, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And I'm drinking gin now because tequila had been making me so mean. You understand, right? And while he was gone, I don't know if we have any drunk dialers in the room today, but I started drinking that gin and dialing the phone, and I don't know all who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman's shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life, and she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. And and I found an AA meeting that night. It was there then. It's there now. It's a perfectly wonderful meeting. It was not far from where I lived, and I went in there that night with everything but readiness. And I'll tell you, that's something you couldn't give to me, and I can't give to you. It's just, it's a moment we have to, I can't give it to you any more than me eating breakfast will nourish you. You know, we've got to eat our own. We got to do our own. We got to take our own road. And I went in there, and I heard a perfectly wonderful speaker there. I didn't hear all of what she said, but I did hear that she said that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer. So I did. Walked out of that meeting thinking, AA says switch to beer. And you know, it allowed me to drink another couple of years. I mean, beer's not really drinking anyway, right? It's more like a breakfast food. And, you know, it gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. I'd get a few things done. I'd come to and have beer and drink beer all through the day. And it sort of, you know, gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. And it was soothing to my body, and I was ready for it. And I wasn't ready to let go. And we were evicted from that apartment and ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard. None of us liked that very much. And I got a little job answering phones, and I went through jobs and jobs and jobs, you know, like it's been said over and over this weekend. I was a good starter. I could show up a few days, and then I would show up drunk. And then someday, after a while, I wouldn't show up at all anymore. And I got this job, and I was bound and determined to keep it. And there were times that I tried to get to that job in the morning answering phones by not taking those morning drinks. You know, maybe I can get from here to the job without taking that morning drink and stop the shaking. And then a whole other kind of alcoholic hell started for me for about a year, you know, and that was when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, and that's all I'm doing. I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking. Sometimes I make it in the morning without those morning drinks. Sometimes I don't, but I can make it till noon sometimes, and sometimes even 5 o'clock. But if I did make it without drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And our relationship, our marriage, everything culminated on a Saturday afternoon. I had gotten the kid back for better or worse about a year earlier, and now she's 10 years old, and the cops are in the driveway one more time, and the neighbors are peeking out the window wondering what's going on at Charlie and Carla's house one more time, and the kid's got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. I can't tell her it's going to be any different. It had been different a very, very long time. And finally, the cops left, the husband left, they took the gun, everybody's gone. It's me and the kid and the beer, and we're sitting there in this little living room. And I'm in a better financial position than I've been in a very, very long time. I'm living indoors. I got a little job I'm hanging on to by a thread, but I got it. I got a little car, and I'm dying of alcoholism more than ever. I know it's just a matter of time. I look around, and I know it's just a matter of time. I was no longer welcome in the neighborhood bars where I'd been drinking. And I was drinking in places called, like, Snafu. and they didn't want me to come in. So I was drinking at home, and our world became very small. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard this whole fight go down. And a couple days afterwards, she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12 and knocked on my door. And she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention, you know, because I was going back to the days of the Nut House. When I wasn't drinking, they were giving me other stuff. When I'm untreated and I've got no sufficient substitute, no steps, no fellowship, no God of my understanding, I've got no drink, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my life gets uncomfortable, so uncomfortable from there that I look at that first drink and knowing full well what might or might not happen, I'm going to pick it up and drink it anyway, because no matter how little that window of relief gets for me, I'm still going to use it. That's going to be a good few minutes. So I got to have something in between, and I'm not quite sure that her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences are going to have any impact on me in the face of what I've become. I just didn't know, because I thought I knew about church, and I thought I knew about God, and I thought I knew about all that stuff, and was deathly afraid I was going to OD on over-awareness if I got sober. There was just there were just too many unanswered questions. My neighbor left, and as she walked out the door, she turned to me and she said, "Carla, do you have trouble accepting life on life's terms?" And I said, "Absolutely not. Life sucks, and I fully understand that." It was about a week and a half later. I just didn't go back and buy any more beer, and the shakes started to happen, and I started to see and hear things that weren't there, and I stayed in that weekend and shook it out. And I didn't. I don't know why that day I didn't pick it. It just happened. And my daughter was with her father that weekend. And I shook it out. And I came to another turning point that following Tuesday. And I went back to my neighbor instead of the store. And I asked her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre. And that became my first home group. She said that there's probably not going to be any question, but go up there and raise your hand and tell them that you're new. And I went up there and sat way back by the exit sign, and I heard a lot of hope in that room, and the hope that I heard came in the form of small talk, and I don't know why that was for me, but it just seemed to me that people seemed to care about each other. They asked each other how they were doing and how the kids were and how's the lawn and how's that job and how's school, and they seemed to know what was going on outside of their own head. Now today I know that everybody was talking, nobody was listening, it just looked like they were having a good time, but I'm just kidding. Mostly. But I didn't know if I could have what you had. I sat through that meeting that night, and the secretary did something very nice for me. She asked me to read a portion of Chapter 11, A Vision for You, that we read at the end of a lot of meetings in Southern California, and I took it from her. I said yes, and I started to read. And as I started to read, I came into the room just a little bit. And if you ask me all these years later, yes is still the best answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I say yes to something you ask me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I come into the room just a little bit more. And I stay in a posture of hearing and delivering the message. Whether I'm reading or leading or washing cups or dumping ashtrays or speaking or going to pick up that newcomer, whatever it is. My favorite commitment was that coffee commitment. I had to drink after 89 days. I had that first step edge came back, and I thought, man, a big book and a beer sounds so much better than this, you know. And just, you know, one more step of surrender. And I stayed out for about 24 hours because as soon as I had taken that first drink, I knew I'd wanted what I had just a few minutes ago, but I had to finish that drunk. And my sponsor came and picked me up, and she took me to the book study that night, and I was not in good shape. And I went there, and they didn't wait till I was sober. Somebody came up and said, "Hey, do you want to come and make coffee with me on Tuesday?" And I thought, damn, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And it made me want to be here on Tuesday. So I started making coffee, and that guy stopped showing up, but I got to make coffee. And because I was up there making coffee, you know, I had my little job. I'd stay there till 5, and I was in the meeting at 5:05. And I was in that meeting at 5:05, even though the meeting didn't start till 8 o'clock, and I'll tell you why. because I was in the grocery store and I was buying stir sticks and coffee and creamer and birthday cards and trying to remember whose birthday it was and trying to remember what kind of cake somebody liked and what kind of cookies to get. And when I was thinking about you, I wasn't thinking about me. And that was the first step of relief that I got. You know, it was the beginning. Until that internal conversion, until something could happen with the steps and I could have my own experience with that, those kind of commitments kept me in the rooms and they kept me thinking about you. And that's how I learned about self-centeredness. You know, I didn't the term self-centeredness. I couldn't get the description. I couldn't get my head around it. I mean, is it on me? Am I doing it now? I don't know what self-centeredness is. I can't be self-centered. I'm a mom. And I don't know why I put those two together, but I did. And but I said yes, and I got a sponsor. My only requirement for sponsorship was that woman had not had a drink for 12 years. She hadn't had a drink for 12 years, and I don't know how you do that. You know, and what cracks me up today is that she was a year younger than I am today. She was 52 years old. And I thought, what the hell else has she got to do? Her life is over. What else has she got to do but pay attention to me? And I'm so glad that that woman taught me to get my own concept of a God of my understanding, too. Because if I had had her God, maybe I would have left AA when she left when I was about 2 years sober. You know, and as far as I know, she's still sober now. But none of that was working for me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about alcoholism specifically. We talk about the spiritual experience as it relates to alcoholism. And I know that there are spiritual experience. Many people come in different ways, but my alcoholism, I was driven to my spirituality under the lash of alcoholism. I was driven to Alcoholics Anonymous. And once I come here, I can go anywhere else I want to and worship after that, but I got to come here first. And so I got to have my own idea of God, and that served me well. I mean, I came here and I had the trouble God, you know. I was what the 12 and 12 calls a bewildered one. You know, I just had so many disjointed ideas of what God was, you know, and none of them really fit, and they weren't continuous, and I couldn't count on them all the time. And a lady named Susan said, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? Just watch that. Just see. And the group, it started with the group, and I had the trouble God. You know, I had a lot of trouble when I got here, and then I got the parking space God, and I liked him. Some people know him as Santa Claus. But I learned how to take no for an answer with that parking space, God. I learned if you want to park here, get here early is what I learned. Because God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but I believe I'm fully expected to do what I can. And somewhere along the line, I've started to believe that I'm a part of what I believe in rather than apart from. And I don't know when or where exactly that happened, but I know it really started to happen, and that's what I count on today. And Emmett Fox calls us a spark of the divine, or a spark from the same fire, and that we've got God's DNA. And I kind of like that. That's what I meditate on. And I took my steps with my sponsor that first year, and I started making that the first round of amends to my family when I was 9 months sober, and the drinks started to leave. I was not one of those people where the obsession was lifted when I walked into the rooms, and I used to hate it having to listen, oh, good for you, yay, you're 2 days sober and the obsession to drink has left you, yay, really happy for you. Because every day I'd go to work and I'd think, am I going to drink now, am I not going to drink, am I going to drink, can I do it, can I get through this day, and panic attacks and all that stuff, and learned how to sit through them, sit on my hands, and just get. I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I probably needed to do that for a couple of years. And made that first round of amends to my family, and it required a lot. You know, none of us knew if this thing was going to work. It required the talk, and then it required a lot of follow-up, because I had followed up on breaking their hearts for a long, long time, and now I was going to have to demonstrate a different kind of action. And to this day, there's not one of my family members who will stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. They just all say, oh, Christmas in June? Yeah, sure, anything. You know, we'll see you when you get back. That's fine. After a while, other women were asking me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. And I'll tell you why. My fifth step showed me a lot, and my sponsor showed me a lot through my fifth step. But boy, when I see it in your eyes, when you share those secrets with me, and I see the growth in you, I see redemption, I see lovability, I see forgivability. Man, I think that maybe that can happen for me again and still. And so I share that something very special goes on between two alcoholics when they're sharing on that level. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, but my daughter didn't have anybody. She was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. She needed some big help. Way up in front of our book on page 19, it says, a more important demonstration of our prisons in our homes, occupations, and affairs. If I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. It was time for me to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and go to 1 meeting a day, go to work, and go home and be a mom to that kid. And I was scared to death, because I'll tell you, I am not proud of this, but I had become every bit the parent that I had judged. I had become every bit. I had no tools, and I didn't think I had the answers for her. And a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me, and then I had to put her in a treatment center. There was a treatment center with a program that was going on, treating kids with what was going on with her. I mean, they said that the gang influence back then at her age was a thousand times more powerful than drugs and alcohol on them. And I don't know if those stats are specifically true, but I know it had her and it had her bad. She needed a family. She needed someone to have her back, and her mom wasn't doing it, even though I was being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I started to go to work, and I'd go show up at that treatment center where they asked me to, and we started to work through our stuff. And you guys taught me there that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time, and that I started to learn how to live with those unresolved problems. And she was there for 6 months, and then I was there when she came out. And she came home, and we lived together, and things were better, but they weren't perfect. And then she wanted to go live with her dad for a while and see how that was. And I had to back up and let her go do that. And I had to shut up about my favorite subject, which was how he'd ruined our lives. And... And always, and he doesn't pay child support. I don't know. It just seemed to me that everybody was getting $5,000 of child support a day, and I was I was working so hard. I needed a medal for just showing up and being a mom. I remember reading an article that Caroline Kennedy had been named Mother of the Year that year, and I got pissed off. You know, like full flight from reality. You know. And while she was gone, I continued to work and stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous and pick her up on my weekends, and things got better like that. And I had gotten better jobs because I showed up doing what they asked me to do instead of what I thought needed doing. Now, I've got no education, really, and I still show up and know how to run your business. So I learned how to keep my mouth shut about that, and I learned a few things. And I was working at an investment firm then, a place I never even would have walked in the front doors of years before, would have had no business being there, and now I'm working at this place. And I'm 5 years sober, and I'd gone to the gym that night, and I came home, and I took my shower as usual, and I always feel compelled to tell you that I took my shower after the gym, and I went to bed that night, and I woke up in the middle of the night that night with a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord, and he tied my hands behind my back, and he raped me, and he robbed me that night in my room. And I want to tell you that that night I had at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. And I knew that things were going to turn out exactly the way they were supposed to, whether I liked them or not. And I knew that there would be a way out and through for everybody who needed one and for everybody who looked. I said a little prayer for my daughter that somebody be there in case she had to hear some bad news about her mom. It was only Alcoholics Anonymous that would fit me to be in the presence of mind to say a prayer like that at a time like that. And we quickly returned to me, now what's going to happen to me? But this guy was there. He was there for a few hours. And then at a strategic moment, we got into a little tussle and a little wrestling match, enough to shake him up enough for him to go out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I had known this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. He was from the old life. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I learned that here, and then I can go anywhere else I want to and worship if I want to. There was a trial that followed. They had caught him a couple weeks later through some weird circumstances. And my sponsor told me that I was going to have to forgive him. Now, I had had a man sponsor up till then. After Joanne left AA, then I got Lee. And he was just one of those good old-timers. You know, he was just one of those guys that would say, well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting. Tell you, the day after that happened, I had to talk to a detective again, and there was a friend of mine named Lori who we were thrown together in the first couple years of Alcoholics Anonymous. We really didn't like each other, but the traditions and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous kept throwing us together, you know, in odd ways. And I was talking to her that morning, and I told her what had happened, and she sent her husband over to pick me up to bring me over to their house to stay with them for a few days, just till you can sort it out. Come stay with us. Now, I got to tell you, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no woman sending her husband over to pick me up. And I got to stay there with their family, and her husband and children, and warm up and sort things out. And then Lee came and picked me up, and he took me back to my apartment, and he nailed these big, fat locks on the windows and and let me make friends with my apartment again. And he helped me find some evidence that was crucial to the case that the police had missed that night in the confusion. And we went down to the police department, and it was agreed that between us that I get a woman. And I got Marguerite P., and she was my sponsor for another 6 years. And first thing she said was, you know, you're going to have to forgive this guy. We're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. And I know she's right. But God, the guy had scared me. I'd stand out there on the sidewalk and I'd hear a car door slam and I'd jump and I'd get pissed all over again. And anger at 5 years of sobriety was still one of my favorite ways to respond to my life. You know, anger made me feel focused, like I got a purpose and like you can't hurt me. And yet at 5 years sober, anger's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be sober. I can't be angry. I can't not be angry. And I don't know what I'm supposed to look like on the other side. And that seven-step prayer became my mantra. It wasn't about him changing. It wasn't about any of that. It was about me changing. And I didn't know what I was going to look like on the other side. And I kept going to work. And there was a trial that followed. And as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, and including my ex-husband. And that's the mark I'd left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of a rapist than he was for me. He's never been interested in my amends, and I've had to finally let that go. So they all told their stories, and you know, it wasn't always my intent to go into the bar and sleep with half the room. You know, I went in there for a few angry drinks just to go in there and chill out. But I don't know what's going to happen. Some days I might get away with that, and some days I don't. And I just never know when that's going to be. We had to get a character reference or character witness for me as to who I was at 5 years sober. And I told you I was working at that big fancy investment firm, and the division head there volunteered to come and testify on my behalf. And they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me. And one of the kinder things that's ever happened to me in my sobriety was the fact that when we went back to work, he didn't hold that over my head. It was business as usual, and he never mentioned it again. And it was my turn to testify, and I'm still looking for that little crack in the doorway of forgiveness. How am I going to forgive this guy? Where is it? How do I do that? How do I relinquish this fear? How does it happen, that seven-step prayer over and over? And I sit in the witness stand, and I look out, and I see him sitting at the defense table. And that's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And it occurred to me, maybe not for rape, but something equally as destructive. It occurred to me that what we were two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And just then, like a little crack of light under the doorway, the opportunity to start to relinquish that fear came, and I felt it. And it took a while. It took about 18 months for me to allow that to happen, and for all the nightmares and all that stuff attendant to something like that to finally go, for the jumpiness and the fear and the anger and all of that and inventories. And I knew when it had finally started to happen, when I was driving down Huntington Boulevard through Arcadia, and I was on my way to work one morning, and it was early, early in the morning because we were on New York time, and I was stopped at a red light, and I looked across the way, and there was a car coming this way, and she was parked too. It was a woman, and I saw a guy in a car, park his car right behind her, stopped, and he got out of his car and he started walking toward her car, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to get her. Oh my God, he's going to get her. And I had to sit and watch this because it was a red light. I couldn't go. I couldn't act like it wasn't happening. And I sat there and I watched it. And when he got closer to the door, he took her purse from off the roof and handed it to her. And I get these little living videos every now and then, you know, that tells me that things are changing and my perception of life. You know, there's stuff going on. With that rape, you know, I couldn't help but have to ponder again, you know, if God is love, how does something like that happen again, you know? And they just simply told me that not everybody's out there looking to do God's will. You know, sometimes you get in the way of somebody not looking to do God's will, and it's not penal. And look at all of the help that came to you. I mean, my home group swooped in around me, you know. They were there at the court trial, and they were there at the sentencing, and my dad showed up. He was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17, and he's not been able to stay out of prison. He's back in and out, and I hear about that from time to time. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous is available in those places because I get to go every now and then. I get the privilege of going up to Central California, in particular, to the men's prison up there. And, man, I see some miracles happen. You know, I see some guys coming to terms with their alcoholism and getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of those guys are never getting out. They are never getting out, and yet they found a way through Alcoholics Anonymous to be useful to themselves, to each other, and to the people that they've harmed, and they've made real amends, and I get to go up there and hang with them for a while, so I know it works wherever it's worked. And one of the guys in there says, you know, my peace of mind doesn't depend on my address, it depends on my attitude, and he's right, you know. I'm not sure if what impresses me more, the fact that that's happening up there or when I go to county jail to do a panel and after the meeting's over, one of the girls or one of the guys will come up to me and they'll say something like, you know, I used to sponsor 5 women or I used to sponsor 10 guys or I used to be secretary of the so-and-so meeting and yet now we're sitting in county jail. The detective who worked the case came to me after it was over and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. I my troubles are of my own making a lot of times and I have bankrupted myself. I've taken some big business opportunities in sobriety and hooked up with a guy that I met in a meeting and he said all the right things, and I thought, you know, sometimes the difference between my will and God's will is just a whisper, you know, like we're going along, and then I'm like, okay, I got it from here, and I quit a really good job right, working for the chairman of the board of several insurance companies to go start a business with this guy, and all of that seems fine, and like you should take that opportunity, but it's always good when you're going to be in a relationship that both of you are in the same one, you know, that. So at 10 years sober, I end up bankrupt and owing a lot of money, and I had loaned him a lot of money, and I was angry again, 10 years sober, and by then I had to take some big action, and I had made an appointment with a psychiatrist. I thought that maybe 10 years was all I was going to get. 10 years was a good run, and maybe now I needed some additional help. And I never ended up going to see that psychiatrist. I called a lady named Rita, who had paid back a whole lot of money, gotten herself in a position like I had, and paid back a whole lot of money that she didn't spend. And I changed home groups. I moved over to the West Side, and I got busy again. I started over in Alcoholics Anonymous without having to drink, and I've had to do that a couple of times, you know, in my sobriety. And reincorporate these steps in my life on a daily basis, where I'm not doing it by rote, but I'm doing it for real. And I got busy again. And I want to tell you that my daughter came home to live with me again. I got to have her home, and I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. And now I have 2 grandsons, 10 and 15 years old, and they've never seen me drunk. I'm just Grandma Carla. I got to sit with those boys a year ago last summer at Cal Poly Pomona and watch their mother graduate with a bachelor's degree from that college. And she's going to be a probation officer. I got to tell you, that apple ran screaming from the tree. You know what I mean? It was, My dad doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well, and he knows why. My mom was the hardest. When she passed away a year ago, July, of end-stage liver disease. She had cirrhosis and hepatitis, and it had just been a long, slow, painful death for her. And about 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And we were all at the hospital, and I'd leave the waiting room, and I'd go out to the van, and I'd drink, and I'd come back into the waiting room, and I'd just rake my mother across the coals and blame her and talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. And that required listening. And really, that's all my mom ever wanted from me, was to listen, just listen. And over time, we became very close. And I started to find my way in and do some of those anonymous acts where, you know, it was hard to get past her. She always knew what was going on. But if I could just be kind to her and try to hear what she needed and give what I could to her. And we became very close. And so much so that about 8 years ago, when my baby brother died of this disease, he was 6'10", 160 pounds, 30 years old, when he lay dying on a Spokane hospital table. And he had little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. And mercifully, when he died, I got to go out and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. When I was 17 years sober, you know, I don't know about you, but exercise and movement and all that kind of stuff has always been a good, you know, staying healthy, keeping the vehicle alive or keeping the vehicle in good shape has always been good for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my sobriety, in my life. I mean, you know, there's a certain chemical change that happens. If you do a kind act, it makes you a little bit happier. When I do some exercise, it makes me a little bit happier. And I've done a lot of that. I did the gym, and I did the rollerblading, and I tried surfing for a little while. And my friend Lisa says surfing is kind of like being in a domestically violent relationship without actually having to have a partner. and I found that to be true for me. And I was starting to get hurt, and I was looking for the next thing. And I'll tell you, I've been single a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been single in my sobriety. I came in on a divorce, and it was exactly the catalyst that I needed. I didn't know how to have a relationship with another human being like that. I have friends who have been married and divorced more times than I'd had cups of coffee with people. Because you guys taught me not to settle. You guys taught me not to go for Mr. Right now when Mr. Right was might be somewhere. You didn't promise me he was. You know, you said unconditionally, wife or no wife, boyfriend or no boyfriend, job or no job, I stay sober regardless of circumstances. So I learned how to get happy, but I got to tell you, sometimes it would get to me, and I had to learn. And so all this is coming to a point. I walked into an Arthur Murray dance studio one day when I was 17 years sober and 47 years old, and I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know that I needed. That's how I know I have a God these days, is he answers questions I don't ask out loud. I just end up there. And I went into this dance studio, and I took the first complimentary lesson, and it was a rumba lesson, and I didn't realize how tight and stiff I'd become, you know, just kind of like that perfectionistic, you know, you throw yourself into whatever's in front of you. And God, my sponsees were getting a little bit like, well, I don't want to call her, you call her. And we didn't know. But so I go in, again, this rumba lesson. We get about halfway through, and my teacher says, oh, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I don't think they will believe you anyway. You know, in the ninth chapter of our book, it says that in God's hands, our dark past will become our greatest possession. And my past has been woven into a huge tapestry that is my life. You know, it's there for those who need to see it, and yet I walk a free woman in the real world, awake and alive and looking you in the eye. My friend Don N., he's an old-timer from our group, and he came up to me later and he said, I don't know, I was kind of afraid that you'd get so tied up in that dancing thing that you'd leave AA behind. You know, you just love it so much that'd be all you wanted to do. And he said, but I can see now that the little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who dances could come out. And see, I've had a lot of windows. You know, Howard P. always says, wherever you see God, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And we all have our ways, whatever it is for you. And if you're new, stay long enough to find yours. When I'm dancing with a partner and I allow myself to be led, If I stay in the moment and I don't worry about the step I just took, and I let myself be guided into the next, and I don't worry about the step I'm about to take, I never know what pattern I'm executing until I'm done. And that happens in my life too. Right here, right now is where God is. God is in this moment. He's everything. And if you're new, I hope you stay here and you get to find yours. Thanks.